Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please this honorable court. My name is Claiborne S. Newland. I'm local counsel for Asbestos Workers Local 42 Welfare Fund, the appellant. David Gordioso, my colleague, will be making our argument.
Good afternoon. If it pleases the court, my name is David Gordioso. I'm counsel on behalf of the Asbestos Workers Local 42 Welfare Fund. Your Honors, we are here today on a matter involving the preemptive reach of ERISA as it applies to subrogation actions that a plan would follow in order to recover benefits that were paid out to a beneficiary and subsequent to the beneficiary receiving some third party or some other insurance recovery, whether they should be able to keep that double recovery or whether the fund is within its rights to recover the monies paid out. It is a matter of great importance to Local 42 funds, not so much even for the amount of money that's at issue, approximately $43,000, but because of the underlying principle that is at issue. And for that reason, I say that this matter is of great consequence to ERISA funds throughout this state. You will be determining whether or not subrogation agreements pursuant to an ERISA fund are worth the paper they are printed on. I dare say further, without hyperbole, that your decision will resonate throughout the country on this matter, as the Supreme Court of the country has seen fit to provide some vague, cryptic guidance on this matter.
Well, this is not an issue that the United States Supreme Court has spoken about at this point.
Well, Your Honor, to the extent that the court has weighed in on it, the court has simply said that they express no opinion.
Right. And what about the federal circuit courts?
Well, the federal circuit courts, Your Honor, are somewhat split on the issue. There is a Ninth Circuit court decision, the Providence decision, which was explained in depth in our briefs. That case, I think, is a very clarifying explanation as to why this matter is not preempted under ERISA.
Is there any reason to believe the United States Supreme Court is going to resolve the circuit split? Are there any petitions for cert pending?
There are no petitions for cert pending, Your Honor. But I think if you want to look at and perhaps into it, the way that the Supreme Court may go, I think you only need to go back to the Knudsen case. The Knudsen case was the case that actually brought us all here today. It's the case that says that these are such cases such as this is seeking monetary damages, not equitable damages, and therefore ERISA does not apply, or you cannot bring your action under ERISA. But the sentence before, and this is a sentence that that I think is lost, it's certainly lost on the Florida appellate court, the MEBA court, that ruled that ERISA benefit plans are basically betwixt and between and that there's a legal conundrum. But they lose sight of the fact that in the very sentence before where the court says that they provide no opinion as to whether these types of matters may be brought to the state court, the court says there very well may be a means by which a remedy may be sought by the ERISA funds. Then they say they express no opinion. But you could also look at
For one moment, you were telling us that there's a Ninth Circuit case that held that there's no preemption.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Which circuit court held that there was? And in what case?
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I misspoke. It's not the cases. I think I should be very clear as to a primary difference between a case that is a case for benefits and a case that is as this is.
Right, we're talking about repayment.
Well, I'm telling you, Your Honor, to my knowledge, there are no circuit court nor any Supreme Court decisions which say that such a case as you have before you at the federal level is preempted. There are state court cases which have been cited by the appellees and which I believe we have addressed.
As I understand the briefs, we have the Ninth Circuit saying no preemption and the Ninth Circuit explaining why they disagree with the state court decisions that have said there is preemption.
Correct, Your Honor. And you not only have the Ninth Circuit, you have your colleagues on the Hawaii Supreme Court in a very clear decision in the Bosk matter, which was a 2006 matter. This case, it's duplicate, and which goes through the state court by name, explains the deficiencies in the state court's reasonings that hold that this is a matter subject to ERISA preemption. Your Honors, going back to...
Did you say is or is not?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is or is not a subject of preemption?
Well, the Boss case makes very clear why this is not a matter for preemption.
The Ninth Circuit case deals with benefits or with subrogation?
Subrogation, Your Honor. And that's... and again, I don't think I can overstate the distinction that has to be made in these two types of cases. And this is a distinction that was not made by Judge Tolliver below. Every case, save but one, which I can also explain why that is distinguishable, every case cited by Judge Tolliver supporting his decision that this matter is subject to ERISA preemption was a benefits case. The one case that was not was a case out of New York State where the legislature in New York enacted a law which mandated certain benefits for women who were pregnant. It was a little bit different than the other cases, the other benefit cases, where someone was making a claim that the ERISA fund illegally or unfairly denied them benefits. But the Shaw case, the New York State case, is also at its heart a quote-unquote benefits case. There's a that would absolutely go to the administration of the plans. It implicates benefits. There is a fundamental difference in cases that are simply a matter of attempting through contract law to recover from a third-party recovery of a beneficiary and a case for benefits. That is exactly what the Ninth Circuit said in the Providence case. It is also the decision of the Bosk Supreme of the Hawaii Supreme Court in Bosk. The case that the appellees will cite to you to say, well, there is a court that tells you that cases for benefits should be treated the same as cases for reimbursement is going to be the Kemp case. The Kemp case comes out of the same district as the Providence case, although the Kemp case is a state court case. Providence is the Ninth Circuit case. Well, the court in Providence by name explains why Kemp is inapplicable, as does the court in Bosk. The core problem I think you will find with Kemp is one of timing. Kemp was decided in February of 2004. It was decided approximately 4 months before a Supreme Court case, the Davila case, which is cited by both the appellees and myself. I'd like to think that if the Kemp court had the benefit of having that particular decision before them, they certainly would not have reached the conclusion that they did. The reason is simple. The Davila court, Supreme Court in Davila, absolutely makes clear why there is a fundamental difference between a case for benefits and a case simply trying to recover benefits paid out.
Well, if it's a if the suit is for benefits, then manifestly the action is one to enforce the ERISA agreement.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And
your point is that this is not such an action. This is an action to enforce a subrogation agreement that is not the ERISA agreement.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
But the difficulty with your relying on that distinction, we are told by opposing counsel is that your complaint does make all sorts of references to the ERISA plan can be construed to suggest you are enforcing the agreement, of which the subrogation agreement is a part.
I understand your argument, Your Honor. The answers are somewhat numerous but very clear. First off, let's be clear about what it is that the appellees are arguing in that respect. They are doing that proverbial arguing out of both sides of their mouths as, first off, this issue of preemption was never raised in any of the responsive pleadings that the appellees filed below. Not only that, if you look at the historical pleadings, the arguments, the responsive pleadings filed by the appellees in the state court are the verbatim responsive pleadings that they filed in the federal court.
Yes, but you're not claiming that the issue of preemption was not fairly presented in the Superior Court, are you?
I am arguing, Your Honor, that it was never made an issue in their responsive pleadings.
And my question is, so what, if it was otherwise fairly presented below?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think you have to go back to the historical documents. If you look at what the appellees argued to the federal court, they argued that the underlying issue of whether or not the fund is eligible to recover its benefits paid to his clients, that this is a matter that should be in the state courts. Once we're in the state court, they turn around and say, wait a minute, this is a matter subject to federal jurisdiction.
And what legal conclusion follows from those two facts, that they argued that the case should be in state court while in federal court, and then once they got to state court, they never raised in their pleadings preemption?
That there was an estoppel issue, Your Honor.
Is that in your briefs?
No, but I certainly am.
Are you asserting that they are estopped to argue preemption?
I am certainly not making any arguments that go beyond what was briefed, Your Honor, although we did make it very clear this historical.
Then is there any legal relevance to what they, I mean, there may be equitable relevance, but is there any legal relevance to what they may or may not have done in the other case?
No, Your Honor. And the reason, again, if you go back to the Providence case, if you go back to the Boss case, both of those courts said it doesn't make a difference. In fact, if you look at Providence tells you that it is the nature of the cause of action, that this is an action to recover based upon the third-party recovery of the appellees.
But the cause of action, I understood, is delineated in the complaint. And your complaint makes all sorts of references in this cause of action to the ERISA agreement, which is my original question. How are we to deal with that?
You don't have to deal with it, Your Honor. You don't have to deal with it because it doesn't make a difference that there are references to the plan. There's no mistaking. This is an ERISA plan. You have ERISA-defined beneficiaries and participants. You have ERISA-defined fiduciaries. That doesn't change the underlying nature of the claim. That's exactly what the Ninth Circuit said in Providence. Bosk, your colleagues in Hawaii, concluded that even if there were references to the plan, it doesn't make a difference because the cause of action was at least to some degree based upon the existence of a subrogation agreement. And that's what you have here. This is an enforcement action for the subrogation agreement. But even if there was no subrogation agreement, Your Honor, it wouldn't make a difference because fundamentally what the plan is attempting or what the fund is attempting to do does not, A, implicate benefits in any way, shape, or form. There's no question as to the benefits that were provided to the appellees. And it doesn't go to the administration of the plan such that preemption is triggered. That is the finding of Bosk. That is the finding of Providence. But I think, Your Honor, we can make it even somewhat clearer to show you why those the mere fact that you have references to the plan doesn't really change what should be the outcome, that ERISA does not preempt this matter. Again, going back to the Supreme Court's guidance in Davila, Supreme Court said that you have complete preemption if the cause of action either duplicates, supplements, or supplants a federal cause of action. Well, obviously, Your Honor, this matter does not duplicate or supplant a possible federal cause of action. There is no federal cause of action. Judge Farnan up the road already concluded that this is not a matter that comes under ERISA. So now, under Davila, you look to see if this is a supplemental action, if this cause of action supplements a potential federal cause of action, ERISA, or if it's independent. And Davila provides the guidance for that. It says a matter is supplementary if it could have been brought under ERISA, one, and two, if there is no independent legal cause of legal duty implicated by the cause of action. Well, we already know this matter can't be brought under ERISA, and there is an independent legal obligation implicated on the defendants in this matter. They signed a subrogation agreement, the legitimacy of which is not in question. Your Honor, to get into the...
There is a relationship, though, is there not, between the signing of the subrogation agreement and the fundamental rights that the beneficiaries, I guess the defendants here, have under the plan. That is, they wouldn't be covered under the plan unless they agreed to pay back whatever medical expenses were advanced.
Well, Your Honor, as Judge Tolliver even acknowledged and provided case law, a case
citation
to.
Is that a yes?
Yes. Okay. That it is that the requirement that a participant or a beneficiary sign such an agreement is a legally valid one, and he gives the case cites to that.
So the right to enforce, that is, the right to benefits under the ERISA plan is burdened by the obligation to pay back whatever medical expenses are advanced. There is that relationship.
Well, if you want to look at it just from the point of view of the plan, yes, Your Honor. You could also look at it from the point of view of the subrogation agreement, which makes the same.
From any point of view.
Yes, Your Honor. But, Your Honor, I think we could escape this entire so-called legal conundrum by just going through the second part of the appellant's case, which is something I may add that Judge Tolliver below never even commented on. And that is the question of whether or not an action that cannot be brought under ERISA 1132 can still be preempted under ERISA 1144. And there are numerous cases, Your Honor, that we cite. And unfortunately, the only guidance from within the state is from the bankruptcy court.
You would agree that one of the other issues that Judge Tolliver didn't reach is whether your client should prevail on its contract claim, and that if we agree with you that there's no preemption and this is remanded, that there would still be a question of whether the uninsured motorist coverage is something that was subject to being repaid.
That is correct, Your Honor. That's not a liability issue. It doesn't go to whether or not this matter can ultimately be in state court. But, yes, it is a tangential issue.
Well, that's going to be the main issue. You want this case tried in state court, and the issue is, do you get repaid or not?
That is
correct. And as I understand it, their primary defense to repayment is going to be, we agree to reimburse you if we receive money from certain sources, but one of the sources did not include our own uninsured motorist coverage. Now, I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just asking you if you agree that would be the issue in the Superior Court, one of the issues, if there's no preemption.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, certainly. It was an issue that they brought up in the federal court. It's an issue that was repeated verbatim here. But that does not require an evaluation as to or an interpretation of the plan such that ERISA preemption attaches. That doesn't go to the administration of the plan.
No, I understand. I'm just trying to get you to focus on what we're deciding and what we're not deciding. And what you want us to decide exclusively in this appeal is that there's no preemption and that all of the parties can litigate their claims and defenses in the Superior Court.
You have summed it up very succinctly, Your Honor. That is the matter before you. That is as, and please let me finish up so I have some reserve time. But since Judge Tolliver's decision was simply this, ERISA preempts this matter, and that's as far as he went, that's the only issue that's really ripe for your adjudication.
May it please the Court, I'm Charles Snyderman for the Brewsters, the appellants in this case. And some of the questions that Your Honor has asked, I think, I need to address as well, because counsel says, on the one hand, that this claim is about the subrogation agreement, and then he says even if there weren't an agreement, the claim still would not be preempted. But that's completely inconsistent with the position taken numerous times in their briefs where they say that this matter can be decided by the court below, should you remand, based on the four corners of the contract. And as I say,
the contract being the subrogation
agreement, Your Honor, yes. And our position is that, as a matter of fact, as we said in our briefs, this cannot be decided by the court below based on the agreement. And, in fact, the court's going to have to interpret the plan because the – and I might add that the reason they're having a problem is because they worded their documents poorly. And, you know, they have a plan that explains what subrogation applies to. And the plan uses language such as – should any benefits be paid? The agreement talks about if we pay a medical expense for which you recover damages from an insurance company, then we have to be reimbursed. So one talks about benefits, the other talks about damages. One talks about from any source, the other talks about, well, the purpose here in our enforcement effort is to make sure that the person responsible for your injuries is the one who pays. So I submit that if you were to remand, as you suggested a moment ago, Your Honor, the court below could not possibly decide the matter based on the four corners of the agreement. The court below would have to look at the plan, and I intend to bring up the fact that the plan and the agreement are inconsistent. And when they create an agreement, a subrogation agreement, that they insist that a beneficiary sign, that is inconsistent in several respects with the terms of the plan, then the question becomes, well, does the plan control or does the agreement control? And I would argue that the plan controls. And if the plan controls...
Well, wait a second. These sound like very interesting arguments. And I have a suspicion that we may hear them again on appeal the next round if it works out that way. But isn't this all what you would be presenting to the trial court as if the preemption matter is resolved against you?
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. But my point is that the reason this court should not remand and the reason this matter is preempted, their claim is preempted, is for the very reason that I'm suggesting that if you were to remand, the court below would be faced with having to interpret a plan, not an agreement, not a two-page contract. And the idea of preemption is that state courts all over the country should not be examining and studying and interpreting the plan and the languages in the plan.
Justice Berger's point is that to the extent the action is brought based on a subrogation agreement or contract and it incorporates by reference the plan, how the two interact may be something for the Superior Court to decide. But the issue in this appeal is preemption. And my question is, do you agree that if we follow the line of reasoning in Providence or Bosch, that we would hold there's no preemption, or are those cases somehow distinguishable?
I think they're distinguishable, Your Honor.
All right. Help us distinguish them.
Can I talk about the Bosch case first? In Bosch, the court says in the beginning of its discussion that the disputed point here is whether and to what extent federal law expressly or impliedly preempts actions brought by the plan under state law to force beneficiaries to reimburse them for medical expenses paid by the plan where those expenses were caused by a third party and the beneficiary has obtained a recovery from that third party. In our case, they're trying to get the benefits, as Your Honor pointed out, from the UIM recovery, not just the third party. The large chunk of money they're trying to seek is from the UIM.
The UIM represents the third party, doesn't it?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The UIM is...
At least conceptually, because
don't think
the third
so.
Party cannot be found?
No. As a matter of fact, in the briefs, I cited, I haven't focused on it lately, but cited the fact that this court has ruled that UIM benefits are treated differently because they're contracted for. As a matter of fact, on other subrogation issues, if I'm not mistaken, it's workers' comp. The court held that workers' comp is not subrogated to UIM benefits because that's something that the injured person contracted for privately.
Well, help us understand your effort to distinguish the Hawaii case, because you seem to be suggesting the issue framed by the appellant is whether you can have a subrogation contract case in a state court. And your answer in trying to distinguish it seems to be, well, perhaps if the source of the funds you received was from the tortfeasor, but not if it was from your uninsured motorist carrier. Where do we find that distinction anywhere? Or you're asking us to make it?
Well, I was asked, Your Honor, whether there's any distinction between the cases, that case and our situation, and that's one distinction.
All right, well, let's give Providence a try then.
Well, Your Honor, may I just sure. point out that something that I think Your Honor asked could be wrong. The agreement itself, I'm sorry, the plan itself says that their right of subrogation exists even if the agreement is not signed by the beneficiaries. So these cases that we're talking about all involve enforcement of a contract. I don't believe they involve the enforcement of a plan that says you have the right to subrogation, and that's why they say there's a distinction. My feeling is that when you talk about trustees who write a plan and, on top of that, who decide how they're going to administer it, and I would suggest that administering a plan is not just handing out benefits, it's deciding how you're going to enforce it, how you're going to seek recovery so the plan has funds to pay other beneficiaries. That's all important. That's all part of the administration. And their decision to try to seek reimbursement in a way that's different in the agreement than it is in the plan is part of the administration of the plan. I know that.
But in this case, there was an agreement. As I understood, what you're trying to make sure we understand is even in the absence of an agreement, there seems to be a right in the plan to pursue subrogation. But that's not our case.
But it's different. And, right. And I guess the point is, Your Honor, if this case does have national implications, as was suggested, and certainly implications for the state of Delaware, and the court remands, then what I'm concerned about is that we'll have two injured parties, one who signs the contract, subrogation agreement, and one who doesn't, and the plan seeks, or the fund seeks reimbursement by way of subrogation from both, and the one that signs the agreement has to pay it back, and the one that doesn't sign the agreement doesn't. To me, that's not fair, it's not just, and it's not the way the law should be interpreted. So I think that the case should be decided based on the plan, not based on the agreement. The agreement is just a tool that was prepared or drafted trying to enforce what the plan says. The problem is, as I said before, that the agreement isn't consistent with the plan. In fact, it's inconsistent with it.
That's a problem. But if we're looking for what's fair and just, perhaps you can explain to me how there can be federal preemption of a state action when there is no comparable federal action that can be brought that would, in fact, preempt asserting your rights under state law. And it strikes me that here we have the rather anomalous situation where one is arguing that state actions cannot be brought because a federal statute preempts them. And it always struck me that the federal action would preempt them only if the feds give a comparable cause of action option. And we already know that's not here. So if your goal is to achieve a fair and just result, you end up with no result here at all, no cause of action in any court. How can that be the correct interpretation of preemption?
I have two responses to that, Your Honor. The first is that you're absolutely right that that's the situation that we find ourselves in, but beneficiaries have been in that situation for years when they've been challenged, and when they challenge the plan in state court, the plan comes in and says you're preempted, you can't, because it relates to the benefits, and then we get to federal court and there's no cause of action. So, I mean, that's happened many, many times. But I think it's important when you talk about what's just not to lose sight of the fact that in the agreement itself and in the plan, it's very clear that if the Brewsters don't reimburse the plan has the right to withhold benefits, future benefits, that it would otherwise be required to pay. So it's not as if the fund is not going to end up exactly where they should be if there was subrogation that was written in a way that could be enforceable.
But, and to follow up on the Chief Justice's question, where do you get resolved? Where does that dispute get resolved? If the Brewsters say, we don't have to repay that because it's not covered by subrogation in the plan, put the agreement aside. Is the plan the one that interprets its own agreement, and the plan can say unilaterally, well, we think you do need to give us that money, and therefore we're withholding your benefits in the future, and then the Brewsters would have no recourse?
I believe there are situations in ERISA where one party or another has no recourse. And I don't believe it's for the state courts throughout the country to decide inconsistently with one another, perhaps, how this ERISA problem should be resolved. I think it's up to the federal courts. And I think eventually it will be resolved.
Well, that prejudges that it's an ERISA problem and not a straight state law contract problem. I understand your argument why you say it's related to the plan, because the plan may be inconsistent with the subrogation agreement, but I think it's fair to say every day states are interpreting contract law within the state, and perhaps from time to time looking at legislation from other states and doing so, as well as federal legislation. And I have some difficulty understanding why that's a distinction here, particularly when the feds didn't supplant the possible state contract action by providing a federal cause of action that's comparable. If they truly intended that states wouldn't be interpreting subrogation agreements or subrogation language in ERISA in a way of enforcing state contracts, they would have provided for a federal contract right and demanded that all ERISA language be the same for subrogation rights on behalf of the plan or an opportunity to resist a subrogation claim on behalf of the beneficiary. But how can you interpret it otherwise than that they leave that up to the state causes of action to sort that through when they don't provide a comparable action of their own?
Your Honor, I don't pretend to have the answers to all of the ERISA problems created by the Supreme Court decisions and the district court decisions and the state court decisions. What I do have an answer for, at least I hope, is that this is not the appropriate forum, the state of Delaware at the state court level, to solve that problem, at least for Delawareans or others who file suit in the Delaware courts.
Well, is it true that the District Court of Delaware decided it's not an appropriate forum to decide it under federal law because there was no federal cause of action?
The federal.
Are we in some kind of la-la land here where the feds say they can't do it and then you are just to say we can't do it, so the parties are left to fend to their own devices, whatever they may be? Are they going to have a jousting tournament to decide who wins?
If the plan, if the fund, which was the drafter of the plan, had written it in an unambiguous, clear way that was consistent with the plan itself, which controls, in my opinion, and if they had filed a cause of action that said, either in federal court or the Court of Chancery or the Superior Court, that said, this is a breach of contract action, and we're trying to enforce a two-page contract, I might agree with their position, but that's not what they did. In all of the courts, this was a action to enforce a plan. It was based on a plan. And it's just throughout their briefs, throughout their documents, the very first letter I got from Mr. Truskowski, saying that they had a subrogation right, quoted only the plan, not the agreement. I think this is a last-ditch effort changing the whole nature of the animal to try to get in one way when they couldn't get in another. And it's just wrong. And when you look at the court below, and you know, sometimes it's easy for an attorney, maybe just me, to lose sight of why we're in front of the Supreme Court. It's to look at what the court below did and decide whether the judge was right or whether he was not right. And the appellant is saying in their brief that the court below made a finding of fact based on the record before it that the fund requested reimbursement based upon the subrogation agreement. That's what the court below found, and I think the court below was correct, that they requested reimbursement based on the subrogation agreement. They then go on to say that it stated the Judge Tolliver's opinion is an extreme interpretation of the statute and that the court below essentially concluded that any action involving an ERISA fund is subject to ab initio preemption by the mere fact that such funds are regulated generally by the statute. But that's not what Judge Tolliver said. Judge Tolliver said, at page 13 of his opinion, that state law claims that are not preempted will ordinarily be those that are peripheral, remote, or directly related to the plan at issue. And, you know, I could go on. There are numerous assertions by the appellant in their briefs about what the court below did, and the court below didn't do that, didn't say that. This is a very narrow issue.
Well, let's assume that we can see through arguments that your colleagues make that have no substance. But as I understand, one of the elements of error that they accused the trial judge of committing is that he basically ruled that ERISA preempts an action that couldn't be brought under federal law. Net result, everybody's in limbo. How does that make sense? How can a federal cause of action preempt a state cause of action when there is no federal cause of action? I mean, I may be oversimplifying it, but that's what's troubling me.
Well, Your Honor, as the Supreme Court has said in the case of State Ex Rel Board of Optometry versus Kuhold, which I was involved in, it's not up to the court to write the law. It's up to the General Assembly. And if Congress doesn't provide for a remedy, it doesn't provide for a remedy. And if Congress says that the states shall not do it, we're going to do it, and they choose not to do it, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, up until now anyway, then there's no remedy. And we're not in limbo. The Brewsters aren't in limbo. They've got the money.
Well, as far as it goes, I understand that. But it is correct, is it not, that ERISA allows either subrogation actions to be discussed in the plan itself or to be part of a supplemental agreement that is a separate contract for the purpose of allowing the plan to collect money from a beneficiary who may receive monies as a result of their injury from a third party. Now, if Congress allows that language to exist in the plan, how can it be an effective part of a plan if it's not enforceable either by interpretation of the plan or interpretation of a supplemental agreement? How could that have been their intent?
The only answer I have for that, Your Honor, is that had the – I hope I'm not repeating myself, but had – I want to make sure this is clear.
If you are, it's only because I didn't get it the first time, so go ahead.
Let me try it a different way because I think you're asking a very pointed question, and it's an important one. Had the plan or the fund, whatever they want to call themselves, adopted a contract, a subrogation agreement, that stood by itself and you didn't have to look at a plan or interpret a plan, I would agree, as much as I hate to say it, I would agree that the court below could interpret the agreement, enforce the agreement, decide how it should be decided based on the four corners of the agreement, the contract. They chose, they put themselves in this position by writing a plan that says one thing and an agreement that says quite another. And in that situation, they have not allowed themselves the benefit of the law the way I think it should be, which is if there's a contract and they want to enforce the contract, let them file suit in superior. I mean, they filed suit in federal court, in the Court of Chancery here. I don't know where else they're going to go next, but the point is that they could have just filed a suit based on breach of contract. They didn't do that. They filed, and if they had, I don't think we'd be here. If the contract was a clearly written, unambiguous contract that was not inconsistent with the plan, I don't think we'd be here. I think we would have lost.
Why isn't that a material dispute of fact? You know, this came up on summary judgment, and you seem to be saying there would be no preemption for a plain vanilla breach of contract subrogation claim. But the reason this one is preempted is because it's tied to the plan. Isn't that something that's decided after you assert the jurisdiction? What? Their argument is going to be the contrary. They're going to tell you, we incorporated the plan by reference, but, you know, this isn't something under the plan. This is exactly the type of subrogation contract dispute that you say would not be preempted. That's going to be their argument.
Well, and if the court below, if this were remanded, didn't have to interpret the plan, I would agree. But unfortunately, the court below would have to interpret the plan, and I think Judge Tolliver made it very clear that he was troubled by the fact that he was constantly being bombarded in pleadings and briefs with the plan, the plan, the plan. And if the case is about the plan, he can't interpret it. He can't enforce it. If the case were about a contract, he wouldn't. I think he would have come down differently. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Your Honors, with all due respect to Mr. Snyderman, there is a great deal of revisionist history going on in this explanation as to why there is preemption and why this matter is the way it is. It has absolutely nothing to do with any interpretive difference, perceived or otherwise, between the four corners of the plan and the four corners of the agreement. I dare say if they were the exact replica of each other, we'd still be here today. There is no case law whatsoever that can be cited where the distinction between any language in the plan and any language in the agreement is sufficient to trigger preemption. It's a non-issue. So to hear today...
Why is it a non-issue?
Your Honor, because you have to look, you don't look at anything other than what is the nature of the cause of action. This is what Providence and Bosk are saying, which, to quote Your Honor, I feel like I'm in la-la land here, listening to the fact that this core issue is is not being recognized, that it is the cause of action that dictates whether or not there is preemption. There's
okay,
case
what,
law
what
to that effect.
What if there were no separate subrogation agreement?
According to Providence, it wouldn't make a difference. And we've had this argument the last time around, Your Honor, as His Honor made a very accurate observation. From our perspective, wouldn't make any difference whether or not there was an agreement or not. Because under Providence and under Bosk, it doesn't make a difference. The reason being, what is the aim of the action? The aim is to recover from the third party recovery of the appellees.
So
that
your reading of Providence is that it would permit a subrogation action in state court with or without a subrogation agreement.
Absolutely, Your Honor. May I quote? A breach of contract action does not have the requisite connection with or reference to an ERISA plan. Plaintiff is simply attempting through contract law to enforce the reimbursement provision. Adjudication of its claim does not require interpreting the plan or dictate any sort of distribution of benefits. Because this is merely a claim for reimbursement based upon the third-party settlement, it does not relate to the plan. So, Your Honor, whether or not there's an agreement or whether we're just relying on the plan doesn't matter because it's the nature of the cause of action.
Let's touch for a moment on Mr. Snyder's argument. He would say Provident doesn't apply because it presumes you don't have to interpret the plan because its language is either identical to the agreement or the agreement doesn't exist. It's pretty clear when subrogation is available and when it isn't. He would argue, and I think he has, that here that a different difficulty presents itself, and that is that the subrogation agreement and the subrogation language in the plan are arguably inconsistent. And in order to resolve that inconsistency to determine contract rights, you have to interpret the plan, and that's what's barred by congressional language.
My response would be to the underlying issue, Your Honor, is that we have plowed a great deal of the field that we may be plowing in front of you someday if you so decide that this is not preempted, as Your Honor accurately has stated. You know, those are matters for the lower court. But the mere fact that you have to take cognizant note of a plan provision, and Bosk is very clear on this, Your Honor, and since I'm out of time now, I will just implore you. The Bosk case answers that question and any question that you could bring regarding this matter. What is very clear is the mere fact that a plan provision is implicated in such a matter as this is not sufficient to trigger preemption. Bosk absolutely, positively is clear on that matter. Providence is clear on that matter. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.